Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. We talk about our favorite records. Talking Records Podcast. We're so glad you tuned in. Thank you all for listening. You showed up to the right place. Jed and his friends dive deep and analyze the records we have grown to love. We'll tell you how we found the band, then give you a track by track breakdown of all songs. So grab your favorite beverage and pull up a seat. Today we'll look at another record in its entirety.
Hi everyone, what's up? My name is Jed, and you're listening to the Talking Records Podcast, an album deep dive show where we focus on one album and round up everything we can about it. In a moment, we'll be joined by Screw 32 guitarist Doug Sengalang to talk about the band's 1997 album Under the Influence of Bad People.
Make sure you check out Talking Records on the net. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Talking Records Podcast. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, or X. You can also drop us an email at talkingrecords@outlook.com. These are all great ways for us to connect with you over all this great music.
Hailing from the East Bay, Berkeley area of California, Screw 32 formed when local musicians felt the scene could use a jump. The band came together fast and hit the road, participating in seemingly endless touring. A handful of 7-inch records and a full-length record on Wingnut Records were made before the band signed to Fat Records. I first heard the band on the How to Start a Fight compilation on Side 1 Dummy Records. My buddy Craig and I used some of the audio from the comp on a class video we made. It was a really fun comp with some great artwork. Anyway, Screw 32 had a song on there, Best Revenge, and the song stuck with me. And then the following year, Fat Records released Physical Fatness, the third in its line of amazing compilations. One of the standout tracks on that comp was Screw 32 and their song Painless. It was a great stop-and-go tune that both sounded very similar, you know, the fat sound, manifested by Mr. Ryan Green, but it also had its own unique elements as well. I grabbed the CD through mail order only to discover the band had broken up. The album was dark and melodic. The band had fast and frantic songs, but also droning moody ones as well. To me, it was like Fugazi meets Jawbreaker while hanging out with NoFX. I can't really describe what captivated me about this music. It just had an interesting feel to it. It was a little different. I liked it. According to Austin Nash in Lollipop magazine, Under the Influence was, quote, a fine and powerful blend of SoCal melodic punk slingshotted into the East Bay. Screw 32 grabs the back of my underwear and holds me up on my tiptoes. So, I'm gonna go with that. Well, welcome to the podcast, Doug. We're super psyched to have you today to chat about Under the Influence of Bad People by Screw 32.
Right.
Excellent album. So, Doug, I want to know, like, take me back to the beginning. Like, when did the writing process for Under the Influence begin? Do you remember?
It started long before we signed Fat, That's for sure, because some of those songs we'd already actually recorded in one form or another for, like, comps or 7-inches and things like that. I mean, you mentioned the Fury 66 split 7-inch. I think My Crazy Life was on there or something like that. I can't remember.
Yeah, you and I were chatting a little bit, and I mentioned that Broken was on the Greetings 7-inch, I think.
I thought the Greetings one was like an original song. There was like an unreleased song that Side 1 Dummy put out.
Yes.
Best Revenge, maybe? But I don't know. I can't remember. We made some 7-inches.
Yeah.
But like a handful of songs like Sticks and Stones, My Crazy Life, that might be the only two that were released already on that one. But we had a couple demos that were kicking around. But, you know, when we first started the band, when the band first started, it was just a 4-piece.
Yep.
Grant, Josh Kilbourne, and Andrew, and Jimmy. And I mean, I played all the shows, but I wasn't in the band for the first couple months that they were practicing.
Mm-hmm.
I was still playing in a band called Big Rig that didn't really last very long. It was never supposed to last. It was just a project. But so we played one show, which we said we're going to do, and released our EP on Lookout. That band was done. It was just like a one-off thing. And Screw the Two asked me if I'd come check them out at practice, and it was so fun. They had so much energy. It was like we were just jumping around in our practice room like it was a real show. And I had such a great time. I was like, man, these guys are great to hang out with. I just want to do this all the time. And the first batch of songs were really more like traditional hardcore, kind of like Brant's old band, Unit Pride.
Yeah.
And just really heavy. Lots of changes, you know, and not really any structure other than just energy. And it was kind of like RKL a little bit, sort of like Minor Threat. And I dug it a lot, but mainly just like hanging out with them. It was fun, jumping around the energy. But when we started writing songs together, it was a really neat thing because it was truly a collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone ever in the beginning came to practice with like a song already written in structures or even a riff. We just would kind of play something and someone would be like, that's cool. And then like, oh, let's go to do this next. And I hear like a good idea for like a chorus or something.
Putting like parts just together. Just
throwing their 2 cents in the pot.
Yeah.
And one song that in the beginning it sticks out was Bandwagon. Jimmy started playing that bass line. And it started building. And we're like, what are we going to do next? And we kept building it all. And we stopped and we're like, what are we going to do? And I was like, oh, let's just play this. And then we went to the next part. And we learned it. And it was that. And sometimes Andrew would say, like, oh, maybe you should play something that sounds like Black Sabbath here. And they were like, let's do like a Bad Brains thing or something. I'm like, all right, I love Bad Brains. I don't know if it'll be that good, but like, we'll try.
Just put all your influences in there.
Yeah. And yeah, that's we're really like, you know, emulating like the bands that we loved. We weren't like trying to give a nod to like the classics of the rock and roll annals or anything. We're just trying to keep it right on the surface of like what was new and present, starting with like, you know, AFI and ending with, you know, Dag Nasty or whatever, Minor Threat.
Yeah.
But actually,
guys are pretty tight with AFI, right? You came from the same.
Yeah, we were really close with them. In the beginning, we played a lot with them, and they did their record on Wingnut also.
Yeah.
Which was like not really a label. That Josh Levine was a guy that like he had some money that he inherited, and he wanted to put us a record out,
mm-hmm.
start a label, and no one would sign us. Like, you know, I just hit made a record with Lookout, and they weren't interested. And, we didn't have any reason not to go with Wingnut. You know, it was like it was kind of made sense.
Yeah, he's like, I'll put
guy, like, kind of a DIY band, and so and then he decided he wanted to do AFI too, and then they asked me if I would like co-produce the record with them, which was kind of cool.
Well, that's awesome.
And you know, it didn't really entail much because they were so focused and driven, and they were such a tight band. It's not like they already knew how they wanted their tones to be and stuff. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, I like helped out with some, you know, harmonies and stuff like that. And but for the most part, they were like self-produced, and I was just hanging out, watching. Maybe sang some background vocals here and there, made a suggestion here and there, and take it or leave it. But I mean, I talk about the easiest co-production gig ever.
Yeah.
I didn't hit him up for any points or anything.
Just hanging out.
Yeah, for that $50 check every 10 years or something. That record's probably sold a lot of records. It's a good record.
By now, yeah.
But back to Screw the Day 2. Yeah, so, and then Andrew just kept us booked all the time. I mean, we were playing like 3 or 4 shows a week, and, you know, maybe some would be local, but lots of places that were like, you know, like bookstores and like, we're playing in Grass Valley and in Redding and Sacramento and suburbs of Sacramento and, you know, always driving out of town, playing secondary markets and things like that. Like not, we still were playing like 3 shows a month, it seemed like, in Berkeley and San Francisco as well. Like
mm-hmm.
we'd have a Berkeley Square show and a Gilman show. Sometimes we played Gilman too many times in the month. And, oh, you can only play her once a month.
Overplaying an area, yeah.
And I'll never forget the first time that we actually headlined Gilman Street and it was just a fluke. One of the bands was supposed to headline, cancel the show. I think it was like 15 or something like that. We would headline, and we're like, okay, I don't know what that really means, but you can play last, sure, okay.
Yeah, well, to you it meant something.
And it was weird because it was like something just clicked. So all of a sudden there was like a line. I'm like, what are they here for? They must think that 15's still playing or something.
Yeah. And, boy, are they going to be surprised.
Back then, people were like trading or like copying demo tapes. Yeah. You had a demo tape that was made and Jeremy Goody recorded and it was a big rig. And this guy Ducky was like a train hopping squatter kid, you know, like he always had his comic bus zine in his back pocket, you know, just going to all the punk houses and stuff like that. And he would come back into town and be like, dude, I had like 20 different people copy your tape for me or something like that.
Oh,
next
thing
you know,
awesome.
Like just kept spreading off. Like who knows how many copies are out there.
Yeah.
I don't even. But yeah, I mean, these kids knew our songs and we're like, wow, this is so cool. There's like 300 kids here and they're here to see us, it seems like. Hopefully they'll come back.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, things were going pretty good. We started touring. We toured with Schlong for a couple of weeks. That was like a pretty wild tour. They would like make like bologna cheese sandwiches in their van and drink tons of beer while they're driving. And then, and then they hit black ice on our way to Missoula, Montana and like rolled their van.
Oh, no.
And they were all okay. Jeez. But they showed up like in the middle of our set. And all their gear was like broken. Their amps were like turning on and off while they were playing the show. And drums were going out of tune and cracked and messed up from the crash.
Wow.
And they're all drunk. It was crazy, but it was packed. This place called Jay's Upstairs in Missoula, Montana. And there was like, you know, the place probably could hold 150 people. And there was like 250 people in there.
Oh, wow.
Sweat dripping off the ceilings and stuff.
Like, yeah.
And it had like a little picket fence in front of the stage. Very bizarre. They made of oak.
Those are the shows you remember, though, you know, like those packed ones where people are like falling onto the stage. And like you said, the walls are
cleaning up the chandeliers.
Yeah. That's
wild. Yeah, no, it was super fun. And yeah, but then from then on, we just, Andrew was a booking monster.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first big tour after that we did, like, we were supposed to meet up with Avail and play a show with them in their hometown, Richmond, Virginia, which we did. And then we were meeting up with the Bouncing Souls and Youth Brigade. But we had to book ourselves all the way out there. I say we, but Andrew did. And if I knew how like disorganized it really was before I left, I might not have gone.
Oh, no.
And kudos to Andrew for not like telling us what was really going on. He was very secretive about like the itinerary, which we could not see.
The confirmed shows.
Grant stepping out of his arms, out of his sleeping bag while he was asleep one night. Like there was one page with like dates and numbers, all question marks scribbled out and stuff.
Oh no!
But you know, we made it out there and we played some pretty funny shows on the way out. Some of them were cool. Some of them were just like bizarre. Like played in some kid's apartment.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being like. He was the promoter. And we're like, oh, so where are we going to play? He's like, oh, you're going to play in my apartment. Oh, okay. Okay, cool. He had like an amp with like a microphone that had a cable attached to the microphone. You know, like one of those like Radio Shack mics that comes with a cable like permanently attached. And that was for the PA. And I'm like, okay, cool. So what time is the show going to start? He's like, well, my friend's coming, getting off work at Roundtable at like 6:30. It'd be cool if we could wait for him to get here.
The other person will be here.
They're like, okay.
Wow.
Sure. And so, I mean, there's like five or six people there, and we played in the kitchen. I remember opening up his freezer for a second, get some ice, and he had like the Star Wars Hoth action figures set up in his freezer. This is so nerdy.
Like set up in the ice that's in there.
But you know what? They all bought like a 7-inch and t-shirts and spray paint and or stencil on their jackets. Charge them $1.
That's cool.
I think we made like $70 off of five kids.
Nice.
Put some money in the van.
It's funny how a show like that, you could walk away with $70. Then like another show you could play, get stiffed and not make anything. Even if there's a ton of people there, you know, like some promoter runs off with
We definitely had some of those on that leg of the tour.
Yeah.
One time we pulled up in Phoenix or Mesa or something like that to this club. It was like a country western bar that, subsequently, we would play many times over in the back patio that they had like chain link fence around. Played them like Lagwagon, a bunch of bands. But this one time we showed up and on this tour that I'm telling you about, and they were like, "Who? Screw 30 Who? Nah, I never heard of you. We have country bands playing tonight."
Oh gosh.
All right. Okay. Well, let's just keep on rolling then.
Yeah. It's like that scene in Blues Brothers where you guys show up and you're like, "We're the Screw 32 Honky Tonk Band."
Yeah, there was a minute where I thought it might be kind of cool to make like a little movie about like that leg of the tour. Will they ever make it? Call it like a Destination X, The Road to Nowhere. Will Screw 32 ever make it onto a tour with a booking agent and bands that have like shows booked?
Yeah, confirmed guarantees. Shows.
Man, we played some bunch of shows though at Lawrence, Kansas. It was a good place.
Yeah.
I remember that night, I think it was like Face to Face or something was playing at like the big rock theater right in the main drag, and like that, like a Nightliner bus or something. And it's just, and we were playing like this like place called the Outhouse, which is like a punk house. It was just like 2 blocks down the street, but like in this house, it was in this like abandoned field, like barn burnt down and shit like that. I remember just thinking, like, this is like so classic. Like, there's the band that you want to be over there, you know, like, all the cushy lifestyle, you know, like, probably getting per diems and stuff, and gonna make like $1,000 each or something crazy. You'd be lucky to make $1,000 the whole tour.
Yeah, we're out here in the back closet,
right? But you know, we kept at it, and eventually we'd get to a point where we had some shows like that, but yeah. No Nightliner, whatsoever.
So you guys are doing all these tours and these shows, and you're putting songs together and stuff.
So yeah, we just kept touring, and we had a bunch of songs written at that point. We had the first record at some point done. That record we recorded, it was like $700 it cost. We recorded all the music in one day live.
Nice. With Andy Ernst, right?
Vocals the second, and then mixed it the third day.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and you can tell it sounds pretty sloppy. You know, we probably could have shortened that one down a little bit, and then maybe make an EP also, and then focus on. It's got energy, so that's all that matters. But
yeah.
But then we didn't really write a whole lot because we were just busy touring all the time. You know, we toured with that one tour with Bouncing Souls, and then we went out with Lagwagon, and we went back out with Bouncing Souls, and we did a bunch of touring. And,
so did Lagwagon know that you guys had a song called Section 8?
I don't know. Why? Do they have a song called Section 8?
That used to be the name of their band.
Really?
Yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
Like way back before, when they got signed to Fat, they were Section 8, and Mike was like, you gotta change that name.
They're really cool. Joey Cape is such a sweet guy. He was actually pretty instrumental, I think, in us getting signed to Fat.
How did you guys actually connect with Fat?
That's a good question, because like we had been talking to BYO Records, and we were pretty serious about signing with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we liked those guys. We toured with Youth Brigade, and
yeah,
super cool guys. And it was pretty much like a done deal. And then like Fat, I believe like somebody reached out to Fat long ago, and we just never heard an answer back. We just assumed they weren't interested. And at some point, somebody said that Fat Mike was interested in signing us. And I was like, really? And then we were talking about it long and hard. There was like, you know, like, I think we felt sort of obligated at first to like stick with what we were doing, because we'd already like, we hadn't actually gotten a contract yet or anything like that from BYO, but we'd been talking about it for a long time. Like, we went and stayed at their house down in Venice Beach, and you know, they showed us the whole deal of how it would be running. But like when Fat Mike, you know, said that he wanted to sign us, and that he was, you know, into the band, I really had to think about it, because what was speaking to me is just, man, those records just sounded like so much better than so many other records that were coming out around that time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the records on Epitaph all sounded great. And, you know, there were still people that were doing good stuff. Pretty much everything that Donnell Cameron recorded sounded pretty good. But, like, not to say that anything was bad coming out of the BYO stuff, but they didn't have, like this one, this, they weren't like a machine for just producing these sonically great records. And I saw, like, and it just seemed like that what was happening at Fat definitely fit with what we were doing production wise. And I really, really, really had a lot of appreciation for the quality of sounds that Ryan Green was getting.
Yeah.
It was really exciting to me. For me, that was like the big thing was like, I think that we're going to have the best chance of making a good sounding record on Fat. And I think that's the case. I'm really actually very, very happy with how the record came out. You know, not totally happy with how everything worked out, but it, you know, it's kind of a sad situation.
We'll get to that.
But, you know, it means all in the past.
Right.
But
at that time, if you were going with Fat, you had Ryan Green. And that was, I mean, that was an era. That was a sound. Like, a lot of those records from 96, 97, 98, I mean, they all sound so punchy and so great. Like, I love those records.
Yeah. And he was really getting into his groove right at the time that we started doing it. You know, like, he'd done a bunch of records at that point. Mm-hmm. And now we started to get comfortable with the Razor's Edge. And when you, that No Effects record, was it Heavy Petting Zoo, I guess, maybe? I can't remember which one it
was. Heavy Petting Zoo, or the one after that was So Long and Thanks for All the Shoes?
No, it was Heavy Petting Zoo. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was recorded just before we recorded. And it sounded so great. You know, like, there's all these different kind of tones. I mean, I think that a lot of the bands, you know, were listening to what Weezer had done with that Blue Album and, you know, Green Day with the tones they had gotten with Caballo. And,
yeah.
And people, you know, just really trying to, like, just step it up in the production wise. And I don't know. I mean, that experience that we had recording with Ryan Green, it changed me as a musician permanently forever. Like, I didn't know that records were made that way. He had a totally different way about going about it. And it was, you know, a little bit awkward at first to get comfortable with, but, like, you just trusted him because he was so professional and just, you knew that, like, that he was looking out for the best interest of the band and that it was going to come out good.
Yeah.
And when you hear what was playing back, you know, it was like, stoked. This sounds great. Like, there was a lot of, like, difficulties though, too, getting there. I mean, I can't even remember. I think that record might have been the most expensive record made on Fat at the time. I don't know if that's true or not, but I heard the rumor. We went way over budget.
Oh, wow. Is that just because of time, or?
Then we kept having these weird problems. Like, I can't. At first, it was like something. There was some problem that made him think that the drums weren't tuned properly or something like that.
Oh, no.
Mark Martinson and Ryan, they drove down overnight to LA to pick up like another drum set, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I almost had Mark come in and join us, but he couldn't. He had a job he had to do today.
Bummer.
Yeah, I wanted him to come. I was like, dude, you got to be my 2FA, my two-factor authentication to make sure everything I'm saying is true. So long.
Cross-reference this stuff.
Right. But yeah, they went down and then picked up a drum set, I thought. And then we retracked drums, and Mark played killer on that record.
Yeah, how'd you connect with Mark? Because this was his first record with you guys, right?
It was, yeah. But he was in Sam I Am.
Yeah.
We needed a drummer. Josh Kilmore had told us on the first tour we did that he was going to be leaving the band afterwards, that he just needed to focus on being a dad. He had a daughter when he was pretty young. And we're like, okay. So then we had Jamie playing with us, and Jamie was great. Like, he was just a ripping drummer. And yeah, I'm not sure what happened with that, because he was like living with me. I think he got interested in, he was just doing something else, or like playing with Dave Ed from Neurosis or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we were like drummerless, and then we're like, who are we gonna get? And what are we gonna do? And I knew that, like, I'd heard that, like, Sam I Am had signed to a major label, and that they were in the studio making a record, and that, like, Mark walked out of the studio that that was the rumor that like he got into some altercation with the producer Lou Giordano, who's like infamous for being like an asshole to drummers, and like having his friend, his best friend, play drums on band's records.
Oh God!
I don't know if that's what happened with Sam, that Sandman, but I wouldn't be surprised. And like, and Mark is also infamous for throwing his fan when he's pissed off when he's playing drums. He always chuck his fan. Which I've been the recipient of that fan before. Not that he actually meant to hit me with it. He was just throwing it.
You were just in the way.
The cord actually hit me right in the head.
Oh my God.
Hit me like a viper, right? That's where I live now, but it was kind of funny. But yeah, I'm like, that guy, Mark Morrison, he rips. He's so good. I mean, like, I remember seeing him play with Sam I Am and just thinking, like, man, that guy's just like, he's like Buddy Rich on steroids or something. Mm. Like, just a beast. And we went, I met up with him. He got his number from somebody. And it's like, I mean, we didn't really know him, but it was just like this like guy that we looked up to that played drums. And like, hey man, we really want to try and talk to you and convince you to join our band. And it's like, I don't know, man. Like, you know, I'm just kind of not sure. I got to think about it and this and that. He's playing with some other bands that are pretty heavy, and seemed like that experience was pretty messed up. Like kind of like one of those horror stories you hear about major labels, you know, like just vibing him out. And he basically like had such a bad experience that he went to the studio and just grabbed the drum set the major label bought him and took off and bailed. Like the band's like, fuck you guys.
Yeah. I'm taking these.
Not the band. I mean, he's still cool with those guys, but that guy, Lou Giordano or whatever. But
yeah, that sucks.
Yeah, so we convinced him to come jam with us, and man, we're so glad that he ended up doing it and playing with it, because like his energy just really carried the band. I mean, he's a great drummer.
Yeah, his drumming is tight on this record.
And like, yeah, and he had some sort of grudge that he was holding about whatever his experience was in that really was like firing him up even more. And that record, that's one thing that I hear all the time, especially like when we were touring and stuff. People were always like, is that like a double kick drum pedal on that record? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, it's a single. Wow. No way. That's like a double. No, that's just Mark. That's how Mark does it. He can roll like a kick pedal and it sounds like a double, but it's not. It's just a single. Pretty neat, but yeah, he played great on that record, and you know, there's no click track or anything like that. I think, I mean, we use some click tracks, you know, to like get started, but maybe, I don't know, I don't think there was, because we didn't seem to really need it. I mean, now it's like everything I do is sort of click track, you know, like really speed it up and slow it down and everything, but like times have changed now. It's like, this is different. This is back when they still called Pro Tools slow tools, you know?
Slow tools.
I've never even seen Pro Tools yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, Mark played great on that record. But it did take a while to get the drum tones. They were really, really picky about that. And then we had to re-record the bass because they thought the bass was out of tune with the drums. No.
So the drums sounded out of tune, the bass sounded out of tune.
There were some tuning things going on. I don't know what's going on about it.
And this was at Razor's Edge, right? Tune.
Yeah, was that Razor's Edge? I think it might have been the room, maybe, or like, maybe, I don't know. I can't say, but like at one point,
it was place is
like,
haunted, right?
I don't know. No one ever mentioned that to me before. Is it haunted?
You know, maybe I always get stories from people. Is it Razor's Edge? Fat Planet is Ryan's house, right?
No, Fat Planet is a studio that Ryan used to work at. And I believe that the guy that owns Fat Planet, or owned Fat Planet's name, is Max Norman. And he was, he famously recorded the first two Ozzy Osbourne albums.
Oh, nice.
Diary of a Madman and Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. And he also recorded a bunch of other metal bands. He's a super cool guy, Englishman. And the Fat Planet was a really weird, wild studio. I mean, it looked like it's some alien pyramid in the inside. Like spaceship-y, kind of like futuristic, like Hollywood set almost. You felt like you're like, it was very bizarre. Yeah. It was cool. But yeah, Ryan worked there. He had his own mixing room there and tracking room. And then there was like a big, huge like SSL console in the main room, and then some like top of the line like Sony digital machine, which I think it was called like a 40R or something like that. I can't remember what the machine's called, but it recorded on half inch tape, a tape reel, but it was digital. So, you know, kind of like how, remember ADATs, how they had like VHS tapes? But it was digital.
Yeah, I have a few of those.
It was like the best you could get for digital back then, but, you know, be surprised if anybody has one of those now anymore that gets any use.
Right. I know. Where would you even like put one of those in?
Yeah, I mean, the machine was the size of like your washer and dryer at home, you know? Like,
yeah.
Both together. Pretty cool. But yeah, we tracked most of it. We tracked the bass and most of Grant's guitars at Razor's Edge. Mm-hmm. A lot of my guitars at Razor's Edge. And then we tracked even more guitars at Fat Planet. And that's where like Andrew finished up his vocals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we mixed it. But it's interesting because Fat Planet looked like a pyramid inside of it. Like I have this like literature, like a one sheet for the place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just super weird. It's like there's like these hallways with like space age runes and like glowing purple lights. And like kind of like it was really neat.
Yeah.
I mean, especially for the age I was in, I was like, oh, this place is cool, man.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't as comfortable as like Razor's Edge.
Yeah.
It didn't smell like, you know, like stale beer and like vomit either. But yeah, Maximum actually helped mix this record, but I don't think that he wanted any credit for it. He just did it for fun or something. I don't know.
Really?
I don't think he's on it, but I know he did some work on it. At least two or three of the songs, which is kind of neat. We definitely had some stories of, had to tell some stories about Randy Rhoads, which was neat too.
Nice. That's always the best part about working with those guys who have like these insider stories about, you know, the bands they've worked with and stuff.
But yeah, so it took a while to record it. The songs were written, so like we had a few that were written, but it took us a while to write the songs because we had been touring so much.
Yeah.
You know, our first batch of songs, we were like, you know, just playing shows around at home. And we play every night. If we weren't playing a show, we were like in the studio practicing.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave us a lot of time to write a lot of music. But then when we started touring, that's pretty much all we were doing. And we would write songs in between tours, but you know, we'd be home for like 2 weeks at a time or something like that. Maybe we'd get like one or two songs kind of on the board, but not finished.
Right.
We ended up doing a demo at Razor's Edge for the album, which was
just like a dry run through.
Yeah, we didn't have all the songs done yet, but we recorded a bunch of them, and that was interesting. And, you know, Fat Mike produced the record, and he helped a lot with like the vocal melodies and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was going to ask about Mike. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that spirit of collaboration like definitely continued on into that record. I mean, it was a more refined sounding record, but it wasn't for any lack of collaboration. If anything, it was just more collaborating. Cause I mean, yeah, you had Ryan that had ideas on like parts. Like he was really great to feedback with cause he's a drummer and
yeah.
Sometimes you have an idea for like way to like make a bridge really cool and interesting, you know, instead of just like looping a part like two times or something like,
yeah.
Yeah. I think it was the song, it was called Something You Said. It's got a kind of cool, like siren style, like social distortion, like guitar part.
Yeah, trying to
arrange the bridge on that, which is kind of neat.
That's cool. So, did you guys do like a lot of arranging and like finishing up songs in studio?
Well, a lot of the vocal stuff got, and this is typical of a lot of the records that I've made. Not Jackson United. I mean, Chris is so on it.
Yeah,
Chris Schiller. He's like so pro, he's always prepared, you know, but like, you know, most bands, lyrics, you know, it can be rough.
Mm-hmm.
Write lyrics and
it can be placeholder for a while. Yeah,
it's hard. You know, I wish I could just write the lyrics first to every song, because I end up always having like a cache of songs that don't have lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so we had most of the songs done, but not all of them were completed. And there was, you know, a handful of songs that there were structures still when we went to the studio. Hadn't been demoed yet. And they were just like skeletons that were really kind of written in the studio. That was nerve wracking because it's like, you know, there was some dysfunction in the band, and like, for sure. And like, we weren't as prepared as we should have been. And like, you just, you know, in my heart, I knew that. But, you know, it's like, what am I going to do? Say, okay, Fat Mike, probably shouldn't do this deal because, like, we're just not ready yet.
Yeah, it's a hard...
I would have been dreaming for about ever since I was a little kid, but, like, you know, you just believe it's going to work out.
Make it happen.
Yeah, make it happen.
It's going to make it happen.
And it did happen, but it was an expensive happen, and it was a learning
And probably experience. If it's stressful when you're trying to work a part out and it's not really working and you're, like, watching the time go by and then the money's adding up and you're like, oh, you know, we got to finish this part or this song, and I imagine that could be really...
The funny thing is the creative aspects of it, it never hindered us. Like, that stuff all came together really fast.
That's good.
It worked out well. I think it was like technical problems, like we were talking about, like,
oh, yeah,
tuning issues. Like, we went back, recorded the bass, recorded the guitars. Sometimes, like, you know, I mean, honestly, I didn't always even hear, like, the problems they were talking about. I wasn't listening with such a discerning ear that I could probably hear that now for sure, because, like, you know, consider myself to be a producer and an engineer also. And, you know, I really focus in on that stuff. But yeah, I mean, and then what really took a long time is the vocals too, because like they were really like, that was one thing that Fat Mike was clear on. It's like the song, the melodies have to be exactly right. They have to be there. Mm-hmm. They have to be intent. You got to get them down. Like, Andrew worked hard to get that stuff done. I mean, you can hear there's a big difference in the singing styles on the two records.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like he really like worked hard to get it right, and it was cool. I'm proud of what came out, you know. And he was really open to like trying new things and stuff too, and being more melodic. And I think it came out well. But it was a hard time, you know. I mean, obviously, you know, the band broke up. So,
yeah.
We toured too much, I think. You can get kind of crazy when you go on the road for more than 6 weeks. It's strange at about 6 weeks, but when you're out for 3 months, it's just like...
Too much for each other.
Yeah.
And so were you guys feeling that tension when you were recording? Was that popping up when you were doing the record?
No, I don't think so. No, not at all. I mean, it was the record was broken up into like two big sessions. So the bulk of the main session was like, you know, the bass and guitars at Razor's Edge and the drums. And then we did a whole nother round of like the guitars, which were pretty much all the guitars again, except for like the Grant's parts and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Fat Planet and then vocals. And then we did like another day of like overdub guitars at Razor's Edge, I feel like. And then and like background vocals and stuff like that. A couple of days of that. And then it was mixing. And mixing took a while. Being really meticulous about it. But I think everyone got along pretty well on it. Everyone was really psyched, you know, we're really excited about it.
Yeah, you're making a good sounding record.
I couldn't believe how it was coming out. It sounded like different than anything that I'd heard on Fat or on anywhere. I mean, not that it's totally different or groundbreaking or anything, but it was like, I'm stoked on how it sounded. I still am.
Yeah. One of the things that really stood out to me about this record was I loved it. I loved that it was a little bit, different than some of the other stuff that was coming out on Fat, and it was a little darker. I remember liking the fact that it was like a darker, more serious record. In 97 than some of the stuff that was coming out around that time?
We definitely always kind of leaned a little bit to that. We had a couple poppier songs, but not as poppy as some.
Mm-hmm.
I think that record is more melodic than in some ways than our first record. Mm-hmm. But then there's other songs that are kind of popular on the first record too. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like Blind Spot and Old Man with a Gun, or 10%. But you know, and you can hear that NoFX influence a little bit, but it's not. We were trying to just fit the mold of like, okay, now we're going to become like a NoFX sounding band. Not right. to say, we all love NoFX and have tons of admiration for like the bands on the label and stuff. The reason why we felt kind of comfortable going there is because like we saw they were putting out like, you know, Good Riddance and Swing Utters, and it seemed like the sound on the label was getting a little bit more diverse. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, I mean, like the core of the label prior had been, you know, pretty much like sound like music that's associated with like snowboarding and shit. Like, that's what I want to listen to when I go snowboarding. And all those bands are great. Yeah, it felt exciting to know that we didn't actually have, we could find a home there and not like sound like NoFX.
Right.
We did sound like NoFX a little bit, especially when that Mike helped us with melodies and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's got like a very signature style. Yeah. That's kind of neat to incorporate.
His fingerprints are on there. But you guys definitely had like some signature stuff. Like your guitar playing, for instance, Doug, to me is very signature. Like I hear your stuff and you do like little things on the guitar that I'm like, oh, that's totally Doug. You know, like I remember you have that song Broken. You know, the year after when I picked up the Fine Girl EP, you were with Limp. And I remember in the song New Reason, you do a very similar kind of like doo doo woo 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 thing on the guitar. And I was like, hey, Doug.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was neat getting to play Limp because, I mean, Billy Bouchard, he played so much cool stuff on that first record. Mm-hmm. That it was like, it was a challenge to learn everything and then try and forget trying to sing like as good as that. I mean, I did everything I could to get the backgrounds covered, but there's no way I'll ever be as good of a singer as Billy. But yeah, it was really fun learning his parts. And I think that like whole experience, like, you know, made me a better player. And, you know, each thing that you do kind of sets you up for the next.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have been able to probably go on to like, well, I definitely would have been able to start my own band where I was writing songs and singing if it wasn't for being down with Phil and learning that stuff with him. But then as a guitar player, like learning Billy's parts, that elevated me too.
Yeah.
And I would have been able to go on and be playing like with Chris Shiblett later, and like without that, it's all this stuff that has to happen in order to make sense of the future, for the future to make sense of the past, you know, stuff has to happen.
Yeah.
You don't think about it when it just happens, but like looking back, you're like, oh, I've never been able to go from this, from like Screw the YouTube, just the last thing I did. Never would have worked.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you definitely pick up a lot from those experiences. You mentioned Big Rig. Did you pick up any like songwriting tips from Jesse?
Well, yeah. I mean, Jesse was like, he still is a great friend of mine. He's like a huge influence on me, more in like a sort of a transcendental sort of way, like as far as songwriting, spiritualistic, like he's just kind of like a guru, but like,
yeah,
lyrically, he's always what dazzled me about him. I can't hold a candle to anything he does lyrically, but like, I mean, he's helped me with lyrics on a bunch of my own records. He contributed lyrics to both the One Time Angels records.
That's awesome.
We collaborated on it. He wrote some of the lyrics entirely on some songs. Some songs we collaborated on together. Some of the songs I wrote him, but he wasn't even in the band.
Yeah. He's like, I'll help you.
But yeah, definitely learned a lot from him. And also learned a lot from him about how to like stick with the core inspiration and energy of a song. Mm. For sure. That was something mm-hmm. I picked up from him. He's really good at like knowing like what works and being in tune with what's working for him.
Yeah. And not wandering too far from.
Yeah. It was a trip. That was a trip playing with Jesse Michaels. Like mm-hmm. experience was very bizarre.
Yeah.
Cause I was a huge Operation Ivy fan. I mean, like Tim Armstrong was like probably like one of my favorite songwriters of all time.
Yeah.
I think he's great. And I've always looked up to him. Everything he does, I think is cool. Mm-hmm. And then Jesse was like, you know, the best frontman ever. I mean, Op Ivy was such a great band to see live, and the record was so good. I mean, it was like, had the same energy as like the, you know, the Beastie Boys' first record in a way.
Yeah.
But it was like, it was so new and fresh, and you know, it's like no one could ever emulate that again. I mean, it was like so great. But
there's just an explosive energy that I don't think. Well, I don't know how you could ever capture that again. It was like new, you know, like that kind of thing, you know, the scenes and all that stuff. It was like a lot of, it hadn't been really done before. Yeah. You said it, freshness. There was just a freshness to all that, that really transcends through that music.
Yeah. Like Operation Ivy is just like, when they play live, it was like a positive, like riot mentality. Mm. Like you could not be in the room and not like get sucked into the magnetism of the whole event, you know, like, I mean, everybody was just like freaking out in place or jumping off the stage or, oh, it was just great. And the shows were awesome. Saw them a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. Seems like I would always end up like holding up like Tim Armstrong's mic stand, you know, and he's like, at me on the head, like, thanks, man. Like, yeah, just trying to keep the mic stand up, knocking over it. Yeah, those are good times.
Wow.
And Joey, I guess Jesse, he moved to Nicaragua for a while. Mm. He was in the Peace Corps after he left Op Ivy.
Yeah.
Me and Jeremy Goody, who was the bass player, bigger, we've been playing as a group, the four of us, Kevin and Brandon and Jeremy and I. And we're just like writing songs. We didn't have a singer. We kept trying out people to sing. And it's just like one like crazy bad audition after another. Like the one guy that comes is just like, well, yeah, I don't know. I just couldn't, you didn't, couldn't sing. Next guy's just like, ah! Yeah. The whole time, like, that's all you had.
Whoa.
And literally, that's what all he was doing, like screaming just like I did just right there. We couldn't find anybody.
Yeah.
And it's so hard because people don't just walk around going like, I'm a singer. Some people do, but they're not commonly known of. Jeremy and I just happened to run into Jesse Michaels at like a coffee shop by Telegraph Avenue called Wall of Berlin, I think. Mm-hmm. I remember being like, dude, that's fucking Jesse Michaels. And Jeremy goes, oh yeah, it is. He's like, hey, Jesse, what's up, dude? You back in town? Come sing for our band. He's like, what? Okay. When?
Just we're do like, it. What? Just come on.
Yeah, he just invited him to come down to practice. And he's like, yeah, I kind of feel like playing music. And he came down. And wow. I couldn't believe it.
That must have been awesome.
Like, how did you get that to happen?
Yeah.
Just like asked him and he said yes.
Right.
It's not supposed to happen like that.
Interrupted his coffee and.
Yeah. And then that was weird because like we had like these songs and he's like, yeah, just play your set. He just kind of sat down like quiet and like just lit his eyes closed. Like he's kind of like listening to stuff, not really moving. And, I'm like, oh man, does he like hate this stuff or what?
He's falling asleep.
He's kind of like picking at the carpet a little bit. We play like our whole set, maybe like, I don't know, seven or eight songs. He's like, you know, all the songs are good, but I could kind of really relate to like this group of them. He's like, play that one that he names like some song and hums it. And we start playing that one, Allison just like jumps up in the air. And he's just like, ah, like doing his Jesse Michaels thing with the stage moves. And he's singing like lyrics that he already had written and memorized or something and mm-hmm. just working it out to the song. And like by the end of the practice, that song was like in the can.
Wow.
Like, man, that's so great.
That's awesome.
This is really going to work.
That's amazing.
Yeah. He's like, yeah, I like this stuff. He's like, some of it's just like not in my realm of being able to like sing it or I'm not going to be able to be inspired. But he's like, if you guys are down to like work on the stuff that there's chemistry on, then you know, maybe we can make a record or something like that.
Wow.
Just put out, do a project, maybe play a show. He's like, I don't want to be in a band full time or get back in that whole world, but like, it'd be fun to play a show and make a record. That lookout would put it out. And we're like, okay, what are you going to do?
I know. Nah. No thanks.
Yeah. We're just going to go, we're going to get back.
Yeah, we're another guy. Wow, that's an amazing story, Doug. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was just crazy.
That's great.
I started to have all these little tricks for making all the parts come together because, you know, we're collaborating and everyone's got these ideas and a lot of times it made sense, but some of the times it was like, okay, so if we're going to do that, how are we going to, if we really want to pay that part next, how are we going to get there? So there'd be a lot of like buildups like, like coming up and speeding down, like, you know, I just do the chunk thing and then drop into the bouncy part, you know? You have these little techniques. Oh, they could just take that part and then we can have these little bridges that we use and, you know, still the same sort of like formula to the next song that comes around. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we really liked mixing up like the boom bap boom bap beat with like the bouncy rock beat.
Yeah,
like almost like Boston, band Boston.
Yep.
It's funny because actually I love that band, but Blimp covered that More Than a Feeling song too. But
that's right, that's right.
But yeah, so Screw 32. We did have a little bit of that rock vibe. I think we picked that up from Avail too. You know what I mean? Like, or like, what's the song by Blue Oyster Cult, Godzilla?
Godzilla, yeah. Nice. So, Doug, do you recall from the time after this record came out, what were some songs from the album that you guys really liked playing live? What were some standouts?
My Crazy Life was always a bar murder.
Yep.
You know, Misunderstood was pretty good one live. But that song One Time Angels actually was a song that that would go really well.
Yeah.
And not one of my favorite songs to play live, or it was fine, you know. That was like an old song that had like been with us for like from the first batch of songs, so it was done earlier on, but I think it's had something to do with that second half of the song where it goes into the fast part, you know,
Circle
Pits song.
And the crowd
is always
nuts.
Kind of fun. Some songs that were not easy to play live or go below, like the last song on the record,
Responsibility.
Yeah, I don't know why we had a tough time with that. I think that was the one that had the most like influence with Fat Mike had on a song with like vocals too, like the melodies and stuff. You really hear it at the end section.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something that the guitars are detuned in that to like a drop D on the E string.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of my issue with it, because you really need to have like a dedicated guitar
that's tuned that way. Out. Yeah.
Rather than changing the tuning on a guitar.
Right.
You know, just to have like a whole other guitar on tour. I mean, sure, I had a backup guitar, but to have a whole other guitar like just for a drop.
That's tuned for one song, yeah.
It makes a lot of sense.
Seems kind of like a waste, but
you never really, like, if you couldn't play the song really in tune unless it was like intonated for the drop D. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I guess that song never really like hit its stride live. But I think pretty much all the other songs went over pretty well. Like Something You Said is a song that I think we didn't expect to be one that would be a song that went over well, but it actually did somehow.
Yeah.
It's kind of a weird song. You know, I don't know, even know how to describe it. It's kind of like a limpish kind of thing going on. Although like not like Bag Lunch, but maybe kind of like,
mm-hmm.
It's just got like a weird rhythmic thing going on. The only road that leads back to place where that place left me, dark things they born again. It washed away the new fluid. Held on to the end. It was one of the few songs that like I like kind of had like it all arranged, except for the bridge, which Brian, which Ryan helped out with. But yeah, it was fun to make that record. It was like it was a neat experience. It was the first time I'd ever recorded something where we like recorded everything like pretty much individually.
Yeah, so instrument by instrument.
Yeah, it was just like we stripped away everything, you know. So it was like, I mean, we played live scratch tracking with the drums, but we didn't keep any of that stuff, and we knew we wouldn't.
Yeah.
But it really made us a tighter band, I think, by virtue.
So your last show ended up being in April of 97, a mere 2 months after the album came out. So if you don't mind giving us the version of the version you're most comfortable with, why did the band split?
Well, I can tell you what my take is on it. And, you know, I risk bumming people out by being honest about it, but I'm just going to be honest about it. This is what happened. Basically, you know, I love him to death, and I want him to do well, but you know, he struggles with sobriety and addiction, and as we all do in our own ways, everyone in the band to some degree or another, but with different, you know, with different ways of dealing with it, and you know, his sobriety was really important to him, and him and Grant were old friends, and it was just, I think it was really difficult for him to be in the band because, you know, we were all partying and stuff, and like we weren't like a crazy hard partying band. Well, some were. I mean, I would become a harder partier later, but I wasn't really a hard partier in the band then.
Yeah,
I would become a hard partier when I owned like a bar and working bars. But I don't party all anymore. But I think it was just tough for him. And
yeah, it's gotta be tough.
Yeah, and you know, there was other stuff going on behind the scenes, but like, we toured for a long time, and he was starting to, you could see that it was like wearing on him, and he was having conflicts with Grant, and they'd known each other since they were kids. And there's a couple times where it was like, it seemed like it was going to end on the road, and you know, like there were long talks, you know, like a lot of times like I'd be like with Andrew trying to like work things out, like talk, hear him out, and just kind of keep everybody separate. There was a conflict or something, and to just get everyone to talk through it and get back on the road and keep it going. But like, I got the sense that the dysfunctionality was going to start to get the best of us soon. Like, because it was just no hiding it after a minute. Like, after 6 weeks on that tour, like we played with like, we were on tour with the Queers and Groovy Ghoulies for like 2 months. And we've been on tour when the record came out for a while. And it was a weird tour. It was like kind of like, they were billed as the headliner of the Queers, but it was really like a co-headlining kind of thing. Even though they were the headliner, but you could see a very direct division of the crowd. They'd have like, you know, 200, you know, kids that they were like, you know, mainly like girls that were in the band, which is cool. You know, I'm not making a gender thing about it at all, but you could see that there was a very clear difference. Then our crowd were like, you know, sweaty boys were like wearing hard shirts. They wanted to like, you know, circle pit and stuff like that. And like, so you could see like what was going on. And they did, but the two crowds didn't really have a lot of interest in each other's bands, which was like any other tour that we did. Groovy Ghoulies fans and the Queers fans mix together all right.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because like Joe King from the Queers, he also was a recovering alcoholic addict and like in the program and stuff. So we thought it was kind of cool, like, you know, support for Andrew because he, you know, he's, you know, straight edge or whatever. Or intending, you know, that's his goal. And but you know, I don't think it worked out that well for either of them. You know, like just the tension around everybody else that was partying, and then like it seemed like, because the guys in the Queers are hardcore partiers too, except for Joe. So I don't know, I think it was just he started feeling more isolated along the way, and
yeah.
And then, you know, the longer you get out there, it's like, it's just, you know, everyone's having a beer at like soundcheck after a while, you
night
know?
After night after night. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we kept going after that 2 months, and then we were touring on our own, and At the Drive-In's our support band.
Oh, really?
They were blowing us off the stage like every night. And the show was small, you know. They'd be like, you know, 25 kids one night, and then like 225 kids another night. Mm-hmm. If you're lucky, you know, 300 or 400 or 500 kids another day. They were every night. Didn't matter if there was one kid or 1,000. They would leave the stage just destroyed, like just they left it all in the gym, you know, like
yeah,
all in the ring, whatever. Like they went all out there, and it was impressive to see them. They were so cool.
They were flying through the air and jumping and swinging their guitars.
Big band, but like we were like, what the hell? That was humbling.
Yeah.
I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but I mean, you know, it was clear that like that it was going to be a long road to get where we wanted to go. But we had a tours book all throughout the year. We're supposed to go to Europe with No East Frame, Temple Pole, and like we had just tour after tour after tour booked. And I was excited, looking forward to it. But started noticing that the shows became like real hit or miss for Andrew. Like he started having trouble like finding that placing himself where he could actually put it out there. And when you're on tour and you're playing every night, you have to be able to like you have to be able to deliver it.
Yeah.
You know, whether you feel it or not. Mm-hmm. And it's hard. Some nights you're not feeling it.
Yeah.
You still got to do it.
But while you're on that stage, yeah.
But yeah, I could kind of see like he was going through it, you know, and I was worried. But I was just trying to pretend like it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. I'll be okay tomorrow. And I don't know what happened. We were playing, we finished up that tour, and then we were doing like weekend shows like with other bands. Like we were doing like a weekend show with like Citizen Fish and Fury 66 and The Criminals, and we were playing it in Sonora or Twain Heart or something like that at the Borderline Warehouse, the skateboard shop warehouse. It's like 400 kids at the show. Is packed. I don't know what happened, but like at some point in the middle of the set, I just see Andrew like drop the mic, and he's just standing there not singing. I'm like, what's going on? Like, is he like having a nervous breakdown or something? And like, didn't really know what to do. And then I see Grant like going up to him, and he's like yelling at him, like, sing. And like,
yeah.
No, that's not good either.
Oh, man. Finish the set.
And like, then Grant starts trying to sing the song. And then Andrew yells something like, play the next song. Like, I think I accidentally skipped a song in the set because I was like, did not sure what was going on.
Yeah, now you're nervous. Yeah, you know, what's going on?
And he'll be like, play the wrong song, or play Speed Freak or something. Like, okay. So I play that, and he kind of sang that song. But then afterwards, he just goes, this is my last show. This is the Screw 32's last show ever. I quit.
Wow.
He dropped the mic. And he left.
And that was it.
Yeah, and our band had broken down earlier that week. So we had to take two trucks with all of Europe to this particular show. And he left, and he was with one of the trucks.
Oh, no. He took off with one of the trucks. Oh, God.
Really? You just bailed on all of us? With all our gear here? And Fury 66, they were from Santa Cruz, you know, and they drove. They helped us get all of our shit back to the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. Man, we were so bummed.
Ugh.
I couldn't believe it. I was kind of mad for a while.
Oh, I bet.
And I didn't hear from either. Like, it's not like I thought he would call me back the next day and be like, dude, I'm sorry. Like, it's blah, blah,
yeah.
And that. Like, I waited a couple days before, like, I told anybody what had happened because I just didn't want to believe it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Is this really over? Yeah.
Been going like for 4 years straight, which, you know, it's not that much time now that I'm 50 years old. Mm-hmm. But like at that time, it seemed like, you know, that's how long high school is.
Right.
4 years is
And that's a lot of work put in, too. That's a lot of putting.
Yeah, and we're supposed to do it right. We had everything planned. I was like, oh, my God, how are we going to tell this to Fat Mike? I can't believe this. Andrew just quit.
Yeah.
But he wasn't happy. So what do you do? I mean, I think he regretted it. I mean, I have to believe that he regretted it because I mean, he wanted to do reunions. Like, he's called me every year after that. So let's get the band back together. And I was like, I never even like apologized to me. We're all cool now. And everything's all wonder under the bridge. Like, at some point, I was like, dude, you should just do it. Get the band back together. Like, I can't do it, but I think you should.
Go for it.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's wild.
Fat Mike was cool about it, too.
Yeah, I was going to ask, was Fat Mike just like, dude, we just sunk all this money into this recording. What are you talking about?
No, I mean, that record cost $80,000. This is crazy, right?
Yeah, that's amazing.
And Fat Planet was expensive, too. That record studio cost like $2,000 a day or something.
Wow.
I don't know how it all added up. That was also included, like a van and like equipment, and merchandise that we bought for take on tour that we still had.
Yeah,
we sold a lot of it, but we were supposed to do at least two records, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it probably recouped eventually, but like when you think about like how much CDs sell for, you're like, okay, well, CDs sell for $6 wholesale. It costs like $1.80 to manufacture.
Yeah.
You sell 60,000 and over the course of two decades, and you still profited on it. It's not like you lost any money in the end, but
right.
You know, at the time I felt terrible. I felt like, oh my God, this is my worst nightmare.
I can't believe we did this to it. Yeah.
So he's like, just get another singer. That was Screw 32 and Andrew. Like, you can't be like Screw 32 without Andrew in the band.
Yeah. His voice is very signature for that.
Make a new man.
Mm-hmm.
And we were totally cool with that.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, we'll make a new band. But then Jimmy was like, he had a kid. And he's like, man, you know what? I'm not going to do this anymore. We already knew that he was thinking about winding down and, you know, departing after like a year of tours and stuff. He was going to gradually back out because he had a kid that was like, you know, about to be 4 years old at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't want to miss out on her whole life,
right?
Touring and stuff, and
but didn't he immediately get into Tilt?
But at that point, it's like he's like, yeah, he's like, I'm not, just count me out. Like, I'm not gonna keep working at this, you know, trying to get another singer.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, you know, there's this band, you know, remember Lifetime?
Yep. Oh yeah.
Well, they had broken up, and then there was talk about, we talked with Ari from Lifetime about maybe like having come out here. And that would have been cool, but like it couldn't have been Screw 32. It would have to be something different.
Right, yeah.
Like Screw Time or screw Life Time. 32.
Life 32.
I don't know. But but yeah, I mean, it didn't really come into fruition. Although Peter from Lifetime came out here and I recorded his band. He was also in Justice Brazil for a little bit. But recorded the record for his band San Geronimo, and they were awesome.
Yeah. That's awesome.
But yeah, so we were talking about doing it, but like it was just me and Grant and Mark at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, what are we going to do? And then about, I'd say maybe 3 weeks after we'd broken up is when like Phil and Johnny like showed up on my doorstep. Like, hey, can we come talk to you for a minute?
Do we have an opportunity for you?
Yeah, I thought they were going to like, I thought they wanted to like do, we're going to ask me if they could do like a 7-inch on Adeline Records or something. Cause I was still like working and doing that project. And as a part of that, and I didn't know, have any idea what they were wanted to meet about. But like, when they were like, you want to be in a band? I was like, yeah, man, your band's great.
Hell yeah.
I really liked them a lot. Like I'd been listening to them since Phil had given me their first 7-inch and Phil's a great songwriter.
Yes, he is.
He's super good. And I was super excited to like play those guys. I mean, they're like, it was super fun. And it was like, you know, it was a different like experience. It was like a refreshing change, you know, like the mindset was a different mindset, but it was like a well-needed one for me, you know?
Yeah. Like a whole different vibe.
Yeah. And it, you know, and Mark had like pulled his back now at some point because he paints. He's a painter. He's super physical job, and like he pulled his back, and I was thinking, oh my God, that sucks. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be able to do anything anyway. But he ended up being okay because he joined me for Snake Eating and Gaming, did a tour with them. So it would have been fine too. But those guys were pretty bummed at me when I told them that I was going to play with Limp. Like, it was a hard conversation to have.
Yeah.
Grant didn't talk to me again for for pretty much forever. I just finally spoke to him when COVID was going on. I finally called him up and was like, dude, you know, I ran into you a few times and you snubbed me, and we used to be really close friends, and nice to put it behind us.
That behind you. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Glad you're able to do that.
I think he felt he felt like maybe I let him down, you know?
Mm.
Continue to go, but I had to kind of just, I had to do something, and that was a good opportunity. And
you got to move on. I mean, obviously, if it's the band is not going to be doing anything, what are you supposed to do? Wait around?
Yeah, I mean, one thing, it was things were making sense and coming together, but
and then you bailed. Yeah, I could see that. Yeah,
yeah, but it's all of a sudden now we need to start a new band, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
and I would have happily started a new band if that was the only option, but it just, you know, I was grieving from that band still, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was that was a huge letdown.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It
was a FI show at the Greek Theater, like 3 days after. It was 6 days after we'd broken up, the very next weekend, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it was maybe just a few days after I told anybody. So I didn't tell anybody for a few days. And there was some drunk, crusty, gutter punk kids. It was out in front of the place, Spare and Change in Greek. And as we were walking by him, he goes, hey, didn't you used to be somebody, man? Oh. yeah, the word travels fast.
Yeah, 6 days ago, man, I was somebody.
Yeah.
That's funny.
That sucks. But that's kind of what it felt like. It felt like, yeah, I was somebody. No, it's all gone.
Now it's gone in a puff of smoke.
Yeah, but you know, it's just how it goes. Screw the 2 record, I think it was the most expensive record at the time on Fat, and I think it probably was the least selling record. It was the biggest disappointment for Fat Mike. He had been bummed. I put all that money into it.
Well, not being able to promote it, yeah.
But he was so cool about it. He's always nice when I see him and stuff, but you know, there's something in our contract that stated that mechanical royalties are guaranteed from the first record sold no matter what, which is only 7 cents per song, 70 cents a record or something like that. Mm-hmm. You're guaranteed. And our entertainment lawyer did that deal. One point she called me, she's like, you're getting your mechanical royalties, right? From that? I was like, no. She's like, well, you're supposed to be getting those, no matter what happens. So ask him about that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. And I went in and had a meeting with him, and I was like, oh yeah, are we going to get the mechanical royalties? Because they were supposed to get them. They were like, dude, are you seriously asking us for that? Okay, that was a really stupid idea.
Yeah, it's been $80,000 on this thing. It's gonna be a while before you pay that off.
Well, yeah, there's a recoupable royalties, the artist royalties.
That's funny.
And I was like, I see your point. Sure, you wanted. We were supposed to do 2 albums, but then I was mad at my lawyer. Why did you tell me to go ask for that shit?
Yeah, you embarrassed me.
She's like, because they owe it to you. You're supposed to collect it.
Yeah.
First record sold. Yeah, but we broke up. We didn't fulfill our deal. We put all that money into it. It's not right.
We didn't even
it's
make
not
it.
Right.
Yeah.
I find it to be somewhat serendipitous that on this record cover here, you have a horseshoe right there.
Mm.
And if you turn the pages a little bit farther in, what's that? That's a hand grenade, right? And we know what they say about horseshoes and hand grenades, right?
Hand grenades, yep.
Close. Well, close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades.
That's funny.
This is a foreshadowing, I tell you.
Yeah.
We were close to the footnote. We broke up before the internet. If we had just made it one more year, we could have been in the annals of rock and roll as a band. But Only close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades.
That's funny. I never noticed that.
yeah. anyway, it's a pleasure talking with you, man. Thanks a lot. Hopefully, you know, someone will get interested in hearing the record. You know, one more person out there hears it and appreciates it, I'll be stoked.
Yeah, but, I bet they will, because, you know, a lot of people I talk to about this record, they're always like, yeah, I always liked that record, you know? So it's like, I think of the people who heard it, of the people who got a chance to hear it, you know, and gave it a chance. I mean, I know a lot of people probably heard it after Physical Fatness, Painless was on there, and, you know, that song kind of gave a little bit of life to the record for a while. But, yeah, everyone I talk to who's listened to this record is like, I really liked that record, so.
That's one of the things you say. Some of those, like, really, like, catchy riffs, like Painless, that... And Black Marker,
I love that song. That's probably my favorite song on the record, right there.
That's Grant. That's those little catchy blurbs. That's fucking Grant right there. Yeah. He was cool riffs, in my opinion. Like. You just, you know, I always admire Grant. I hope he's doing well.
Well, Doug, this has been a lot of fun, man. I've appreciated chatting with you about this record, and I appreciate you making time to come on and tell us stories and tell us about making the record and stuff. This was great.
Yeah, man. All right. Have a good one now.
Cool, Doug. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That about does it, folks. I would like to thank Doug for hanging out with me today and talking about Under the Influence of Bad People. Such great conversation, a lot of fun. I would like to thank Phil from Limp for connecting me with Doug. I would like to thank Krista Makes from Less Than Jake for the wonderful theme music. I would like to thank all of you, people who listen to this podcast, whether this is your first time or whether you've been with us for a while. We greatly appreciate your ears. It's a blast digging into these records, talking about the music, chatting about the songs, the artwork, the backstories, the recording. To us, this stuff is fascinating, and it's so much fun to do it. I love doing this, and I love connecting with all of you. It is so much fun to talk with you on the socials, talking about records, talking about our favorite songs, all that stuff. So say hello. Suggest albums that we do on the podcast. Also, check out Talking Records Singles, which is a series of mini episodes we'll be doing probably once a month. What are some songs we should do? What are some great songs off, you know, I don't know, albums we might do, albums we might not do. I mean, you don't know which albums we're going to do, but what are some single songs that you think really deserve some attention? All right, folks, thanks a lot. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.